This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the...
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the...
The Place to Be.
Yes, the Place to Be. The Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Ugh. Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling. So.
That's what she said!
So why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola. Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire. Produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Oral. A-U-R-A-L. What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Vincent's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course, as the lacrosse player. Bismarck. No, was it? Bismarck was on his
Bismarck.
Bismarck. No, who's the other guy I'm getting confused with?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big buzz play, and that is in my extra queen size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the fix.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're
doing.
Our opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live here on this Monday evening. A chilly, frigid Monday evening, Scott. I had to turn on the heat tonight, not very happy about that.
I'm not cheap about a lot of things. By the way, JR, good evening. And good evening, friends and family. Welcome to episode 337 of Place to Be Nation's Mothership. And I don't say budget myself because my heat's gas. I don't know what yours is, but I budget mine. I turn it on November 1st and I turn it off April 1st. And then if it's chilly before that, then I'll just throw on a hoodie.
Well, I mean, it's a little different. You're a single guy. You're ready for hibernation.
Yes,
you have plenty of padding, so you're good to go.
Yeah.
Here I got a two year old. I got the wife, so it's if it was up to me, I'd leave it till I got the 40 in here. That's I used to force that upon us when we were. Sans child in the early days.
Yes. I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. Your situation. I'm just saying that I try to avoid it myself because it just because then it ends up getting too hot and you got to play with it. It's a pain in the ass. I'm not a big fan of heat. I'd rather leave the air conditioning on all year.
How about velocity?
But what? How about afterburn?
Yes. All right. After burning our way through this weekend, Scott, where you came in here, we burned our way through a lot of boneheads.
Yes,
and,
we did.
I guess we'll take a minute to give a shout out to our buddy Cowboy Senior. The original Roger Morissette was his big birthday bash over the weekend at Boneheads on Sunday. I was not able to stay all day. I had a birthday party to attend. But they, Andy and the junior cowboy, senior cowboy, and Mrs. Cowboy, they were there from 12:30 until the end of the Pats game. So they rocked it hard all day. But a cowboy senior at the time of his life per Twitter. So So happy birthday to him. And it was good seeing you, of course, over the weekend. Mr. Dan McGinn was down.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we start the countdown till early November.
Yes, we do. Yes, it was always a pleasure to come visit you, and I apologize as well. I sadly had a wake to go to, so I couldn't stay for Cowboy Senior either, but I look forward to meeting him at some point before the end of the year. Well, some point, period. I know I will, but hopefully before the end of the year. But it did kind of sneak up on us. Like, it was fairly warm still, probably all the way through to, like, Friday, and then you and I were around Saturday. We had a couple, you had a family event we had to stop by, and then it was pretty brisk. I mean, the wind was kicking. It's fall has definitely hit us in the face, and that's good in some cases. That is good in some cases. So,
also hit you right in the face is placetobenation.com.
That's right.
A lot going on. We're going to talk about really quick here, and then we're going to bring in our very special guest. We're very excited about tonight. So a new edition of the Heart Traveling Fanboys Longbook Hunters, Guardians of the Galaxy Legacy. So be sure to check that out. Nick and Greg bringing that at you. Place to be Nation's World Cup of TV characters into the final four, Scott. Four remain from the 250, whatever the hell it was. 256
or something like that.
All right, here are the final four. Number one seed, Cosmo Kramer, battles the number five seed, Al Bundy. And number three seed, Homer Simpson, battles number seven seed, Bart Simpson. So Battle of Simpsons there. As of now, Al and Cosmo are separated by one vote. Oof. And this is just day one.
So Kramer was trailing earlier in the day. So
you get those votes in. And the Simpsons battle, Homer up by 50 on Bart. So that one's just about done already. But yes, the other battle will be a tight one. That'll be up for the majority of the week, and then they'll throw the finals up. So if you're new to the show, placetobenation.com, you can just search World Cup of TV characters. It's right under the entertainment drop down on the top menu, and you can get your vote in today for that matchup, which should be a doozy. Mm-hmm. New episode of The Extra Point. You and Dr. G had Kyle Forchetti on to talk a little football.
Oh, no, Dr. G was...
Oh, that's right. You were flying solo.
I was flying solo. Yeah, Kyle and I.
Yep.
And then Joel came on to lament about his Tigers, and then we enjoyed a few minutes, JR, when you get to that point of the show where we did bash the Angels extensively.
Excellent.
So, in fact, a game going on right now.
That's right.
And they're starting shortly, I think.
Well, the Nationals survived. They won today, so that's 2-1 now, that series.
And I think...
L.A. and St. Louis is at 9.
Yeah, later tonight at Busch. So, okay.
The Bush. All right. Jeremy Nichols is back for the month of October with the House of Horror, wrapping up some of his outstanding installments. He looked at Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers. New episode of The Bauer Show. New episode of Goodwill Wrestling. The boys, Will, Charles, and David Bixenspan, infamous Bix, they look at how to fix the WWE's pay-per-view schedule. So if you like their Fixing the WWE series, it was up over the summer. This is the next installment of that, fixing this pay-per-view schedule. New Steel Reel to us, new 22 weeks. A great installment of The High Spot, looking at Steve Austin's, it looks like, impending return now, Scott. He said on a podcast he is training for a comeback.
Yeah.
So Steve and Glenn broke down potential opponents for him. The Cowboy went to class twice last week, and the second time was for ECW Heat Wave 1998. So be sure to check that one out. Also, In Your House Final Four he did. And he also hosted the Sports Lounge with his buddy Rocky and Cowboy Sr. They looked at the week that was in the NFL. If you're a big Seinfeld fan, hop over to PTBN for the Seinfeld series rewatch. We're into season 3, and the next one will be up on Tuesday morning. New episode of The Main Event from last week as well. All over the place. You, Ben, Jordan, and Andrew Reich looked at GFW, looked at Night of Champions, some early Mania booking. A big week for Goodwill. He also did an episode on the legend of Dick Murdoch in advance of the Hall of Fame, Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame voters. Mm-hmm. So check that out. Scott, our Vintage Vault refreshes, for those out there who found us or know us from our written reviews, we're refreshing them all from the beginning. New fun facts, new opinions, new takes, new grades, and we're up through Survivor Series 87. Rumble 88 will be up this week as well. And finally, be sure to check out the Kevin Kelly Show episode 19 featuring Matt Hardy from last Wednesday night. Matt talked for almost an hour about his career, about where he's headed, about his life. So a lot of fun. Talked about a lot of cool stuff. So check that out. And Scott, speaking of the Kevin Kelly Show, that is where our guest tonight joined us last time he was on with Place to Be Nation. And is Dr. Tom Pritchard, of course, one of the Heavenly Bodies, one of the Body Donnas, legend of the game, one of the best minds in wrestling. He worked at Territories for many years. And when he was on with Kevin, he talked about his early, very early days. Got up until right when he started touring a little bit around the indies. And we had to drop him off there. And as it was, he talked for almost an hour on that show. So we decided to bring him back with us, and we're going to pick up from where he left off with Kevin. So we're not going to retrack through all that territory we already covered. We're going to pick up anew. And so if you want to hear the beginning of his career, go to the Kevin Kelly Show episode 18 at placetobenation.com. You click the Kevin Kelly Show banner right on the right-hand side. It'll take you to episode 18. And you can listen to Dr. Tom's, the first part of his interview with Kevin, and then we'll pick up here. We'll talk about his indie time, his touring, USWA, and then we'll talk about his run in WWF, and then what he's up to now. So it should be a lot of fun. PlaceToBeNation.com. You can follow us on Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Twitter, Place2BNation, and PlaceToBeNation at, info at PlaceToBeNation.com if you have any questions for us. Also, if you're going to buy something on Amazon, we have a big Amazon box right on the side of the page. You click that, it takes you right to Amazon. You can do all your duties, all your shoppings, especially with the holidays coming up. And we just take one quick stop at PlaceToBeNation.com and hit that banner, and your whole Amazon shopping experience does not change in any other way. but it kicks back a little bit of cash to us and it helps us keep things going. So we'd really appreciate if you do that, especially with the holidays coming up. I know a lot of people do shopping online. It would really be a big assist if you could go through there, click that banner, and chug along to Amazon. So, Scott, why don't we take a really quick break, and we'll come back. We'll bring in the Dr. Desire.
Because.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, we'll be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right. The Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials one and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Bob. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vandenberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the big four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island, and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers, and a fully stocked bar. Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Richard and the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment and inevitably hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richard and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real To Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
This is the King of Old School, Steve Carino, the true voice of Ring of Honor, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
All right, Scott, and we are back, and it is time to bring in our very special guest. Like I mentioned, he had joined us a couple weeks ago on the Kevin Kelly Show and was gracious enough to donate some of his time here to the Place to Be podcast, and that is the one and only, the great, the legendary, Dr. Tom Pritchard. Tom, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, yeah.
Great to have you on.
Very awesome. Excited to have you back. And we assume you've been working on the Dennis Stamp thing, right?
Well, I have my people call his people, and his people are yet to get back to my people. But as soon as their people get back to me, I'll have my people call your people again.
All right.
He has people?
Of course. Everybody has people.
So is he a liar? Because he said he was by the phone. So I just figured he's waiting for it to ring, and he'd pick it right up.
Dennis has a lot of bookings that he has to take prior to your – and I'm not sure he has call waiting, so – you know,
we want to involve him.
So. Yes, we do want him involved. We'll even double pay him. All right, so Tom, we wanted to pick things up where we left off with Kevin. We covered your early days about how you got into the sports, how you grew up as a fan and whatnot. So we're going to dive in and pick up right where he left off. So we advised our listeners, if they didn't check out that first interview, hit that up and then come join us here. And we're going to start in Portland. Your thoughts working in that office? A different style from other territories, using the 2 out of 3 fall styles of matches. So any thoughts working there and any memories or stories you can share with us?
Well, I actually showed up in Portland around 1984, and I was supposed to go when I first started out, but I just kind of took a detour and finally made my way up there. And it was a really fun place to be. That's where I first met Buddy Rose. I'd already known Matt Bourne and, I met Brett Sawyer there as well, and there was a lot of guys up there who homesteaded. I mean, Rip Oliver was kind of a homesteader guy, didn't go too far from Oregon, and Buddy lived there as well as Ed Wiskowski, and a lot of guys really kind of liked it because, you know, I figured out Portland is so far up in the Pacific Northwest away from everybody. That's where they sent you to really kind of cut your teeth and learn and make mistakes and then come back down, and kind of mix into the mainstream or the South or the Midwest or wherever you want to go. But at the same time, it was a fun territory to be in. It was, you could learn. It was, you had veterans and you also had young guys that, they were just starting out. And it was a great place to just have fun. You know, there was a place called the Bomber. Have you guys ever heard of that place, by any chance?
No,
the
I haven't.
The Bomber Motel, the Bomber. It was I think about 20 cabins, kind of in a horseshoe, and they had an Indian teepee in the middle of this kind of yard, I guess it would be, and that's where most of the boys stayed when they came in, and it was furnished little apartments. And by the way, back then there were a couple places like that. One was the Falcon's Rest in Hapeville, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. It was just a 2-story crappy little furnished apartments that the boys stayed in because they were cheap and crappy, I guess. And anyway, the Bomber was kind of nice. It was little cabins, and you know, you were home every night pretty much. Everybody talked about how it rained and was dreary, but I got there. I had, I think in 1984 was one of the better summers where it was a lot of sunshine. And again, you got to to wrestle 6 to 7 nights a week. Great wrestling cities, great wrestling arenas, and great wrestling fans. They were more or less interested in the workmanship, I guess, more so than they were about the appearance of the guys, I guess, back then. And you could be a junior heavyweight or a cruiserweight, and if you could work and provide action and excitement, you know, there was a place for you on the card. So it was really cool for me. Mondo Guerrero was there at the time too, and I know Mondo from California, and we had a lot of fun together traveling up and down the roads. But my greatest memories were that was where I wrestled Ric Flair twice when he came in to work the territory. He usually came in for a week, and in the cities like Portland and Seattle and Eugene, he would work with Billy Jack Haynes. And the remaining cities, and I don't even remember where it was. I couldn't even tell you, but I worked with him twice, and Brett worked with him twice. So, I mean, that was kind of cool. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. But you can find it somewhere because a buddy of mine found it, but I don't remember the cities. It was the 80s, and it was Portland. So, anyway, man, but I mean, it was everything you would expect it to be back then. And going back to the dressing room during Falls was new, but it was in the Portland Sports Arena. And if you've ever seen any YouTube footage from it, it was a real cool place to work. So, I mean, I had nothing but fun there, and I met Kurt Hennig there for the first time too. So. There's a lot of good guys and a lot of fun, a lot of late nights, a lot of early nights, and I have no complaints about it. It was really cool. I wish it was there today.
It is pretty amazing when you hear, you know, you talk about these different territories, just how many guys you keep saying, oh, and I met this guy here and that guy there, and just the names, and it just gives you a real perspective to how important that system was back in those days. I think all the guys that filtered in and out of all those territories, building up their in-ring abilities or psychology and how to interact with the fans, and then when they finally did reach the national platform, just how prepared they were because of all that.
Yeah, and I wish it was that way again today, but time doesn't stand still. I believe WWE is trying to recreate that by having the Performance Center and booking different towns around Florida and surrounding states. I hear they want to go into Georgia and places like that, and that's great, but it's not the same thing. It's not like it was where you could go to a different city, a different town, or a different area and work all the time and get to know I want to say culture, but a different environment, I guess. You know, the fans were different in Houston than they were in Oregon and California and Charlotte, you know? I mean, but basically, it all came down to the only way you learn how to wrestle or work is to wrestle and work and to get in the ring. So this gave us a lot of ring time back then and a lot of experience, a lot of guys who still love the business for the business, not necessarily because they wanted to be rock and roll stars or actors. They wanted to be wrestlers. So that was the cool thing about it back then.
You mentioned Billy Jack Haynes, and he kind of makes the rounds here and there today with some of those YouTube videos and shoot videos where he's just seems a little bit tapped. Now, was that the Billy Jack you remember, or have you had any recent interactions with him?
Nothing recent, but Billy was always his own guy. I mean, I remember going to Billy's house with Mondo one time, and he invited us over. But right as soon as we got in the door, I mean, usually if you go with somebody, you're going to go, you're going to have a few beers or whatever. And Billy, as soon as we got there, he says, "Hey guys, don't allow drinking or smoking or any drugs in my house." Now, if you look at him today, you'd say, "Really?" But so we go in, and Mondo and I are kind of looking at each other because that's pretty much what we were expecting. And we were expecting drugs and smoking at the house, but that didn't happen. And we went in and watched a movie, and we thought it was kind of weird. And Billy was a nice guy, but he was definitely different. Not as different as he is today. I mean, he wasn't. wasn't that way when I knew him, but you know, he's lived a hard life from what I understand. So, it happens is the only thing I can say.
just happens for sure.
Mm. Well, it does happen, man. I mean, I wish I had a better excuse, but, you know, it's kind of like saying, just say no. Just tell a manic person, just cheer up. You know, it doesn't work that way, man. Sometimes it just happens. And Billy probably said no to drugs back then. Then later on, he said, well, let me try this out. and liked it. So there you go. Mm. Not now, that I know. I'm just saying.
Now, this promotion, this was Don Owens' territory, right?
Yes.
How was he to work with?
Don was a great guy. Don was a fair guy. He reminded me a lot of my mentor, Paul Bosch, a straight shooting guy. If you were honest with him, he was honest with you. And I think he was honest with everybody, I believe. And everybody respected Don because if he told you something, it happened. And he paid you better than most. So he and his son, Barry, were really good. Elton, his brother Elton, ran Eugene, and he was a character. But once again, they were all great people. Portland was a great place. The fans were great. The promoters were great. The towns were the towns were pretty cool too, man. I can't complain about anything up there. Mm.
Do you have any desire at that stage to branch out maybe internationally, maybe go down to Mexico or go to Japan, or did you like the way the U.S. territory system was working for you at that time?
Well, as far as working full time, yeah, I pretty much want to stay in the U.S. I've been to Japan for a 5-week tour, and that was cool. And I worked in Mexico when I wrestled in L.A. But as far as going and working full time, no, I pretty much wanted to stay in the States at that time. I felt like I was either going to miss something, or I wasn't sure that I could pick up the language. It just didn't seem like a place I wanted to be. But I wanted to maybe visit, but I sure as hell didn't want to think about spending a year there. So not at that time. You know, later on it came. Yeah, I might have liked to, but I just didn't have the opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I was on mute there. So our next question here, back to the U.S. USWA and USWA Texas, the logistics behind that, basically two promotions in different universes for parts of 1990, but under the same kind of name. Talk to us about how that worked and your memories of that run there for that when they had the both up and going.
Well, I believe it was Jerry Jarrett who bought out Fritz or the boys, Kevin and Kerry. And just went ahead and started running tours from Memphis to Dallas. And when I got there, we were taking a tour bus on Thursday night after the spot show, whatever spot show we ran. Met the tour bus in Hendersonville, Tennessee, and rode all night down to the Sportatorium. And Eric Embry, I believe, had a big hand in that too. He was a booker at that time, and he was in Texas. He'd been in Texas for a while, and I never figured out, you know, I mean, at the time, until I got to know Eric, I never figured out how he was so good at getting himself in these positions. And then all of a sudden I got to see firsthand how he did it. And it's one of those things that, you know, is there, but you have to put forth that energy if you want to be that. If you want to play the game, you got to really play the game hard. And Eric did. If he wasn't part of the office or part of the mix, he was pretty well gone real fast. But anyway, he was part of the mix in Dallas, and he became part of the mix in Memphis. So I was working Memphis at the time when Jerry started the tours down to Dallas. And that, the money, I talked to Jerry at this stage of my career. I'd already been in Memphis, I think, about three times and knew what the game was. And I talked to Jerry about a small guarantee, and he went with it because I was working with Jeff a lot. And I got to know Jeff, and I got to know how the system worked in Memphis. So I just went, and I had nothing to lose, and I proposed this to Jerry, and to my surprise, he agreed. So going to Texas pretty much every Friday and sometimes staying over for house shows on a Saturday was pretty cool. Again, for the experience, for being on ESPN, and just getting your name out there. Plus, I was having, I think at that time, I was having some pretty good matches with Jeff and Dundee, maybe the Dirty White Boy. I think Dirty White Boy and me might have had some matches in Memphis as well that were pretty good. And that was also at that time, I'm not sure if you remember this or not, when the Moondogs kind of came in and hot-shotted, and it was against Jeff and Lawler.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And conveniently, Jeff hurt his back. So Lawler needed a partner, and they looked at me, and I got to work the Moondog matches, which when they brought those chairs in the ring, that was you can't work those chairs. You have to just lay it in, and they laid it in. And I'll never forget Larry Booker told me, you know, whatever you do, boy, you lay it in on us. And I said, no problem. And when I came back, they said, boy, you did, didn't you? And I said, yeah, you told me to. Because they like hitting you, but I'm not so sure they like getting hit. But that was the match didn't last long, but you knew you were going to go out and just try and give the other guy a concussion.
So. It was great, too, how much their legacy as the Moondogs received a bump from a lot of the After magazines and PWI. Because I started watching wrestling like 1989, so I didn't really know the Moondogs, but I became quickly into buying all the magazines. And that feud and their run in USWA was like a magical kingdom to me. It was like this legendary, like, oh my God, this feud looks amazing. The pictures they would pick and the way they would describe it. It just very cool stuff. That was the first kind of my first early days following independent stuff was through those magazines.
Well, if you didn't get a chance to see the matches live, I mean, it's not really the same. You can look at the pictures and say, wow, they must have been stiff. But when you were there live and you actually heard the shots and saw it, there was no they would control it as much as you can control a chair coming down full blast on your head or your back. When you think about that, you know, these days, you know, the safety and thinking about the welfare of the guys in the ring is number one in WWE. But back then we were just pretty much kamikaze, go full out. And as stupid as that was, that's pretty much what we did. So, that was but I love that kind of business, man, because, people couldn't say, oh, that guy didn't hit him with the chair. No, they did. And they saw it and people could feel it. A real quick story. One time on Memphis TV, Channel 5, my back was killing me, and I asked – it was Larry Booker and Bill Smithen, I think, as the Moondogs with Richard Lee. And they were going to attack me after the match, and I said, would you please not hit me in the back? I mean, my back is just killing me. And they said, don't worry about it. We won't even touch you. Well, sure you won't. They came in and hit me right on the back of my head too, and split my head open. I got 7 stitches. So, I mean, you know, I had to work that night in Nashville, not a big deal, but that's the kind of stuff we did back then too. It was really a cool time, man, going to Dallas, Memphis and, working the towns. Wasn't a lot of money, but it was a small guarantee, and it was fun there too.
Thoughts on working with, you mentioned Jeff, obviously meeting Jeff Jarrett. Your thoughts on working with him when he was just getting started, when he was that young. Did you see potential in him as a future star, and both athletically and you know, business wise? And how was he treated by the boys, being Jerry's son?
Well, see, here's the deal, man. I thought Jeff was talented, but Jeff, being the promoter's son, already had that against him because Jerry didn't understand. Well, I think Jerry did understand. I'll take that back. But here it is in a territory where you've already had Nick Gulas with George Gulas, and that was a classic mismatch. But Jeff wasn't George Gulas. Jeff could actually work. At the same time, Jeff was living in that mansion with his father and driving a brand new car when everybody else was barely getting gas money. So there was a lot of resentment, I think, on that. But at the same time, every time I worked with Jeff, it was just one of those matches that clicked. And there's guys you can get in the ring with, and anything you do is just right. You could tell what he's going to do. You react, he reacts. Timing was great. So I had no problems with Jeff, but I do know quite a few people who did. And you know, sometimes Jeff brought it on himself, but at the same time, I got to know Jeff, and I realized, you know, things weren't always easy for him either. So he worked for what he got, and he had to have Jerry Jarrett as his dad. And quite honestly, Jerry comes from that old school promoter mold, where it was manipulate the boys, manipulate your family, manipulate everybody, and then you're not quite sure what the truth is anymore. And I think Jerry had a problem sometimes, hell, a lot of times, with distinguishing between truth and fiction. And I think it even kind of played over in his relationship with Jeff. So, I mean, I like Jeff, and I thought he was a very talented guy. I thought he had a lot of potential.
Texas versus Tennessee feud. Thoughts in the USWA and revitalizing that feud with the Dirty White Boy in the USWA?
Well, once again, it was Eric Embry's deal. He was a guy who was from Kentucky originally, but when he got to Dallas, you know, he became a reborn Texan, I guess. And I'm actually from Texas. And I, you know, again, at that stage in my life and career, I was kind of I was never one of those guys who was going to make a scene or backstage go back and bitch about anything. I was just happy to be there. But at that stage, I was pretty much not just happy to be there. I'd already been there a few times, and I knew how it worked. So I knew I had to stand up and say something. So I would kind of mess with Eric a little bit. And he thought – and I said something on TV one time as a commentator. Said, you know, why the hell does he call him – say he's from Texas? He's originally from Kentucky. He's not from Texas. I was just – I wasn't shooting, but I was shooting, if that makes any sense. I mean, I wasn't – I was doing it because that was my attitude back then. I was just I was ribbing on the square, I guess. And then we immediately after that he wanted me to be part of his contingent. So we became Texas versus Tennessee, and that was a pretty much easy gimmick, easy angle to do because you know, white boys from Tennessee, and we always. You know, we had University of Tennessee, University of Texas. We knew Texas was better than Tennessee, always will be. So, you know, it was just you had Eddie Gilbert too. You know, Tennessee boys, and then you had Texas boys. Texas, we were the baby faces, and actually we were even the heels in Texas too. But Tennessee, we were always the heels. And Tennessee's a weird state, man. It's back in the. I don't know, early days or dark ages sometimes, man. They still remember wrestling. They still remember Whitey Caldwell and Ron and Don Bass. And those are legendary names here in Tennessee, but they're like from 50, 60 years ago. You know, and that name still comes up. The Whitey Caldwell name is some mythological hero, but he's a small, scrappy guy in Tennessee that you know, is a legend to this day. So I don't know how it happens, but, you know, it's passed down from generation to generation. And you go to some of these spot shows and some of these independent shows around here, which I try to go to as little as possible. And they want to see good old wrestling. And quite honestly, there's not any good old wrestling anymore around here. It's crappy wrestling. Sometimes you can go and find the best crappy wrestling around, and that's about all you're going to find. Mm-hmm. But Tennessee versus Texas was a fun time because you can knock Tennessee and say hook 'em horns. And of course, you know the only thing that comes from Texas are steers and champions. So you know, it was all good. It was all good. I had
a great T-shirt.
Yeah.
Compared to obviously at this time in the late 80s, early 90s, the two big promotions, World Wrestling Federation and, you know, WCW, with a hint of NWA, they, you know, they ditched them and then they brought them back in 93 and they kind of had a back. But that promotion and then WWF, compared to those two, what were your thoughts on USWA and Smoky Mountain compared to the big two at that time?
Oh man, there was really no comparison. I mean, the big two were obviously looking for the national audience, and USWA. This is the way I looked at it. If at one time I gave up and I was content to wrestle for the USWA the rest of my career. And then Jim Cornette called me and said, I've got this opportunity in Smoky Mountain, up in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I said, great, because I'll never wrestle for the WWF, that's for sure. And WCW, I have no desire to go because I know how that is. I would have loved to work with the Armstrongs there, but I saw the way they were treating the Armstrongs. So I kind of knew that was that wouldn't be very much fun. So quite honestly, the USWA and Smoky Mountain knew, I don't think they ever were looking at national, even when they had ESPN. And Jim, I'm pretty sure, was just wanting to keep Smoky Mountain around the Knoxville, you know, Kentucky area, and not really worry about being a national contender. Of course, as fate would have it, that was our ticket into WWF. Now, whether that was good or bad, you know, still is debatable to me. I had some good times in WWF and WWE, but at the same time, you know, I wasn't playing the game there too well. So I was content where I was at, and all of a sudden the other opportunity came up, and we tried it, and it worked for what it worked for, and that was it.
Do you consider USWA the last territory, or the one we're going to talk about in a moment, Smoky Mountain Wrestling, or both?
Well, yeah, I think USWA outlasted Smoky Mountain a couple years at least. And whether they were profitable or not doesn't make a difference, because at least they, you know, they were still running pretty regular, I believe. But, probably USWA as a territory would have been the last ones.
What was the process of Smoky Mountain getting started and getting it off the ground? How were you approached?
Well, have you had a chance to read Jimmy's book about the Midnight Express, scrapbook, by any chance?
No, you mentioned that on Kevin's show, and I meant to go ahead and grab a copy of it when you guys were talking about it. So that's our homework.
Yeah. I've had a chance to, too, yeah.
Okay. Well, then you know, as he was working in Knoxville, mm-hmm. You know, he kind of saw that as an opportunity, as still had been a wrestling town. That's how it came about in his mind. And then he was looking to reunite the Midnight Express against the Rock and Roll. At one time when Dennis left, Jimmy was wanting for a day or two, he wanted me to take Condry's place, but Dusty had already found Stan. So when he thought about Smoky Mountain Wrestling, the Rock and Roll Express had already been released from WCW, and Stan and Jimmy were gone, but Bobby had re-signed. You know, Bobby had a family and kids and had to have people to think about, but I was in Memphis, and Jimmy called me up and asked me if I'd be interested in this opportunity to come in and be Stan's partner and call ourselves the Heavenly Bodies. I thought, well, hell, I mean, I've been in Memphis for a while, and I've done everything pretty much I could do. Why not start this and see where we go? So at that time, man, you know, Jimmy was living in Morristown, and I'd known Knoxville before. I hadn't lived here before, but I'd been in the town many times. I knew places around here, so I thought, why not? And once again, I just looked at it as an opportunity to get out and do something. It was with Jim Cornette at that time, again, and still I think is one of the greatest performers in this business. He can be very excitable, which in turn can lead to some interesting experiences, and it did. And he's also a real loyal guy. I've heard that about Jim for many years. I've known that about Jim for many years, but then being one of his guys on the team, you know, he always, whatever he said came true. I mean, some people may have had different experiences with him, but all my experiences with Jim Cornette have been pretty straightforward and on the up and up. So I can't say anything but good about the guy. And Smoky Mountain Wrestling was a great effort. It's just at the time and the moment that it was going on, the wrestling business was changing. People's attitudes were changing. And they'd seen the Rock and Roll Express. They'd seen us. And yes, we might have had great matches. I thought we had some really great matches. But you can have all the great matches in the world, but if nobody comes to see them, it doesn't matter. So in the end, that's pretty much what happened, I think, is it just ran out of steam. And it was bound to, because the world was changing. And if you weren't on WWE TV or WWF at that time, you were looked at as minor league, and WWF was everywhere. So, and eventually what happened was inevitable. You either joined them or you didn't, and you went out of business. So that's what happened.
Let's take a detour quick off the timeline and do a little wrestling list fun. So you mentioned Jim Cornette, obviously a major role in Smoky Mountain, obviously ran it, owned it. As a manager, from the perspective of a fan, where does he rank all time to you? And who are like your top five managers?
Oh my gosh, man. See, this is where, when I watch Paul Heyman, I think it's because Paul's still active and on TV. Paul Heyman and Jim Cornette are so parallel to me. It's amazing. They're both very passionate. And I think Jim and Paul have to be my number one pick. For me, you remember things as a kid. And I remember two of the greatest, most evil managers as a kid. J.C. Dykes, who managed the Infernos, and Saul Weingroff, who managed the Von Brauners. And then you got your modern-day managers like Jimmy Hart and Bobby Heenan. You cannot leave Bobby Heenan out of the equation. And Jimmy Hart, because he's a real manager backstage, too, just like Cornette was. He would take care of all our needs. He would take care of everything. If there was a plane reservation or anything we needed, he was an actual wrestling manager. He wasn't just on camera. So I think if you have Paul Heyman and Jim Cornette, they're both number one. It's a tie for me. And as a fan, it has to be, they have to be the top two, unless you grew up on Jimmy Hart and Bobby Heenan, just like I grew up on Saul Weingroff and J.C. Dykes. Those are what stick in your mind for different reasons. The modern day managers, you had Lou Albano, you had the Grand Wizard. I say modern day, I'm talking about the last 50 years. That's not really modern day, I guess. But there's no managers out there today except Paul Heyman, and for good reason. You have one who stands out, and you can't have five or six managers anymore, and that's what New York used to have. And now it's again, the world has changed, and the managers I really like, and I think are the great ones, are the ones I mentioned.
And I think it still could work. I mean, we're seeing it with Heyman. I mean, I don't know if because it is Heyman that makes it so great, but I think it's something that still could work to this day. And I've always been surprised that with such a focus on promos and talking, connecting with the crowd that they have today, that they haven't brought them back and used them more.
Well, I think the fact is that there's only one Paul Heyman. There's only one Jim Cornette. Mm-hmm. And if you have five or six of those, then it becomes diluted. You have your Lana, she's a manager, but yet she's that woman, that beautiful foreign yeah. woman.
Legs.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, you have to have it at the right spot. Here's the thing. I believe at one time in your life, you would have had to believe that wrestling was real. Paul Heyman and Jim Cornette both, at one time, at many times in their life, I'm sure believed what they saw and what they watched was real. Therefore, they understand the passion. They understand what they have to do to get someone else to believe that they're real. And they are real. The guys you see on screen are the guys that you see backstage. And you know, we talk about just the volume turned up, but Cornette and Paul, I think, keep the volume turned up all the time. I mean, they're witty. They're never lost for words. And, you know, they can out-talk you. They can out-insult you. They can do anything. They know who they are, and they're intriguing. So I don't believe there's that many people, because too many times I've seen on independent shows and on DVDs that people have sent in and said, man, I'm a great manager. Just watch this. They're acting. They're pretending instead of reacting and feeling it. You can tell it's a rehearsed script. Paul Heyman may have a script and he may rehearse it, but it comes across as this guy believes every word he says. And as he's saying those words, I can tell you, he does believe it. When he talks about Brock Lesnar, he believes every word he says. And Cornette was the same way with whoever he managed, whoever he went to the ring with. He believed it. And there's not too many people out there today that can do that, in my opinion.
All right, speaking of two guys that were great in their own rights, give us the pros and cons of working with Stan Lane versus Jimmy Del Rey.
Well, I'll tell you this. Both were actually pretty good guys.
Yeah.
But Stan was really a great entertainer. He was funny backstage. He was laid back. We could tell jokes. We could laugh. And Stan never took himself too seriously, which might surprise some people, but he never did. He didn't take himself too seriously. He looked the part. And Stan also, you know, when it was time, he just wasn't having as much fun anymore, and he was driving from Charlotte to these towns around Tennessee every week. So, you know, it just got a little bit much for him. When Jimmy Del Rey came on, you know, he was a different type of guy. I've been to bars with Stan. I've been out with Stan, and we were kind of laid back because, you know, we walk into a bar and we didn't have to announce to everybody we were there. In fact, we kind of like to lay low and just see what came our way. Jimmy, on the other hand,
please tell me he did the gigolo gyration when he went to a bar like he does in the ring.
Yeah, yeah, that was pretty much Jimmy. Yeah, trust me, after the second shot of Jack, he'd be gyrating by the bar, and I'm just going, oh my gosh. So, you know, yeah, I mean, he was great in the ring, and I can't say one thing about his ring work at all. But there were times when, you know, we're just two different people. He liked to enjoy himself in different ways than I did, and we kind of you know, went our separate ways after the matches. And that, I think that also hurt our chemistry as a team because, you know, I was going through some stuff and he was going through some stuff at the same time. We just never connected outside the ring. I tried, he tried, but I think we were just there were outside forces, let me say that, in his life and my life that just kind of said, look, dude, you know, I want to do this. You want to do that. It's best if you just do that by yourself. And I'll go in here and I'll do this by myself because I can't afford to step in what you're about to step in. And that's pretty much what it is. They were both great guys, but Stan and I think had an understanding that we both respected each other's space. And then Jimmy came along and Jimmy wanted to make sure that everybody knew he was there, and I was more or less the guy that just kind of said, man, I'll just sit over here while you go ahead and do that, because anyway, if that answers your question, I hope it does.
Yeah, definitely did.
Stan Lane's not a gyrator, so he loses.
No, he is. He is a gyrator, but he's a different kind of gyrator. There's a difference. You know what I mean? I mean, Jimmy did it in a way where, you know, it was like, hey, look at me. Hey, look at me. And Stan would be like, hey, guys, do you want to look at me? Come on over. If you don't, hey, that's cool too. But it was Jimmy was a little more in your face with it. So, yeah.
Compare Heavenly Bodies to Cornette's Midnight Express in any form, whether it was Bobby and Dennis. I was always a Dennis guy anyway. Bobby and Dennis to Bobby and Stan. Either way, compare the two teams.
Well, Bobby and Dennis were have to be one of the greatest teams. I mean, they're in the top five, at least top 10, but I'd say top five too. And so are the Rock and Roll. Heavenly Bodies, man, I don't even think, I don't believe there is a comparison except for the fact that my team was Stan. Bobby was incredible. Nobody could ever replace Bobby Eaton or even come close to his ring work. Dennis, the same way. Dennis was a master. I've worked with Dennis a few times, and he was a general, and he knew his stuff. So did Bobby, and so did Stan, actually. So I don't really think – and the Midnight Express was on the national stage. It drew big money with the Rock and Roll Express. The Heavenly Bodies started in Smoky Mountain, and we got to WWE, but we were never anywhere near – what the Midnight Express were. So I can't, there's no comparison, not in my opinion, at all.
Can you, why don't you round out that top five for us? You got the Rock and Rolls, you got the Midnights?
Yeah, you got the Horsemen, Tully and Arn, the Rockers, Sean and Marty.
All right. See, I Kevin and I did this on his show last week, and I had the Rockers in my top five, and he disagreed.
Well, yeah, but everybody has their different tastes. But I
no, Tom, the answer is that he's wrong. See?
That's how of course he is. Of course he is. But I've worked with Sean and Marty. I've seen Sean and Marty. And I think being a great team is working together and making the other team look great too. Mm-hmm. And they did a great job doing that. And that's not easy, man. Not easy at all.
Did you feel you were destined to fail by being compared to the Midnights as part of the Heavenly Bodies?
No, I didn't feel like we were going to be anywhere near, because I was nowhere near the worker or performer Bobby was. Mm-hmm. But I was just happy to be there again. I was happy to be with Cornette and Stan and allow that that attitude to infect me. You know, by that time, I think I was 30. I'd already been in the business about 10 years. Bobby and Stan had already had that. Bobby and Dennis had this great run. Then Bobby and Stan had this great run. So you knew that whoever Cornette picked as his team, they're going to be compared one way or another. Well, okay, great. But I wasn't going to listen to, well, you're certainly no Midnight Express. My response to that would be, well, who is? There was only one Midnight Express. Actually, there was two. But you know, it was the combination. It was that element of Cornette that was a basic factor in everything. And I don't think I can never compare myself to Bobby. I can never compare myself to Dennis. But just being there with Stan and Jim was good enough for me. And to get where we got was pretty much a lot farther than I ever thought I would. So very happy to be there.
I want to loop back around to your top five, because I think you mentioned three or four. So I'm going to throw a couple of teams at you that you didn't mention, because I'm curious of your thoughts. First off, a team that some consider the greatest of all time and are very different than the teams you mentioned, and that's the Road Warriors.
Ooh. Yeah, how could I forget them?
Yeah. But it's interesting because the teams you mentioned are style-wise very different, clearly, than the Rockers, Arn and Tully, obviously very different guys. But I was just curious your thoughts on them.
Well, the Road Warriors were different than any other team at the time. So they certainly deserve a spot in the top five teams of all time. I don't know if anybody, you know, you've had copies of them. You had Demolition. You had the Warlord and Barbarian. But nobody could match the first. So, I mean, the Road Warriors definitely had the style. They had the size. They had the appearance. They had that aura. And, of course, that's with the Machine being behind you as well. But if they didn't have the total package, then they never could have been as big as they were. But with Atlanta getting behind them, Crockett's getting behind them, New York getting behind them. Of course, they made their way, and they did it honestly, and they deserve a spot as one of the greatest tag teams of all. I mean, I just totally forgot about the Road Warriors. I was thinking Work Rate, but yeah, I would agree. The Road Warriors would be there.
One more question on individual teams before we get back to the timeline. Are the Rock and Roll Express and the Rockers, you mentioned both those teams, it's one of JR's favorites. Do you consider them the same kind of team, or were they very different? Because I never thought they were the same kind of team. But would you say that the Rock and Roll Express and the Rockers worked similar styles or different styles?
Well, I think Marty and Sean worked a lot more high-flying Daredevil style, and Ricky and Robert had some high-flying stuff. I remember Robert doing a flying head scissor and Ricky doing some cool stuff when they were younger, but they were very different, but I think the gimmick obviously was going to be the same. You know, the Midnight Rockers, they took the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express and just kind of added their, you know, added the Midnight Rockers to it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think in that sense, they were the same, but the guys, the individuals, Marty and Sean were definitely a lot more Daredevil and definitely a lot more willing to take those risks. At that time when Ricky and Robert were coming up, in Watts, when they first went to Watts, worked the territory, and then they went to Mid-Atlantic, you know, they were still doing a lot of moves and still doing a lot of stuff. But, you know, they slowed down after a while because that's a brutal schedule. I don't know that Sean and Marty ever slowed down when they were a team. I think they just kept going. So that might have been the difference to me.
Okay. Speaking of Rock and Roll Express, April 1st, 1994, you had a Loser Leave Town match with them. Talk about the setup to that that epic feud finale.
Well, again, we were going to WWF, so we needed to do something. And I don't remember exactly how things came about. I just remember Jimmy set it up for it. It was Pikeville, right?
Or I believe it was. Yeah, I believe it was.
The cage match where Brian Logan came in and counted, and it was the second referee. And anyway, yeah, it was. That's what I'm talking about. Here in the Southeast, you know, these Kentucky towns, Tennessee towns, the crowd still wants to believe in wrestling. They still want to get into it. And even if they know it's a work, they didn't care because we came with the attitude that it was a shoot. So I believe it was just set up that I don't remember right now how it was with Jimmy. Given the impression that rock and roll was going to be leaving. I think that's what everybody kind of thought. But we kind of fooled them and we left. I just remember the match at the end and I don't remember when I saw it. I'll tell you when I saw it was on the Rock and Roll Express DVD. I saw it about a month ago. Mm-hmm. But it was set up perfectly and the drama was there. And I think that's due to, again, Ricky Morton being such a great baby face and knew how to sell and get sympathy still. So, I mean, then we had the final scene and we left, went to WWF. We were back in Smoky Mountain shortly thereafter. So anyway,
So what are your thoughts on that run at WWF? So your original initial stint there is with the Heavenly Bodies with Jimmy. Showed up in it was late 93 and you were there as that team until 95. Were you happy with the way they used you, presented you?
No, not at all. Man, we worked with the Steiners on SummerSlam 93, but it was one of those things. You know, my brother was in the office. I'm not going to bitch to him or say anything to him because you know what I mean. I don't want to be that guy, but at the same time, you know, I kind of knew. We had a match and. On TV, and Pat Patterson wanted to talk to us one time, and I thought, you know, hey, he's going to tell us what a great match we had. But no, he just says, we did everything wrong. We just beat the guys up. We just ate them alive. And I thought, my God, man, you know, what is this? And then I realized it was just, it was bullshit is what it was. But again, we were happy to have the job, and we worked with the Bushwhackers. We worked with the Bushwhackers at WrestleMania 10, the pre-show, right? So, I mean, yeah, that was very, very good. I was happy to be there. It was in Madison Square Garden, the first time there. You know, I'm never going to wrestle in Madison Square Garden. Well, here I am, Madison Square Garden. And it's great. And we were grateful to be there. But at the same time, you know, you had the guys there who knew how to play the game. And we knew how to play the game. I just don't think we had the political allies on our side. And I didn't want to play games. Didn't want to play politics. Never been a real good politic guy anyway. So, I mean, that first go around, no. And with Skip and the Body Donnas after that, even worse. So, you know, it was just a job back then. And that's when it didn't really become that much fun.
I want to talk about the Body Donnas in a bit. The first match that, I mean, I love the SummerSlam matches, and I'm just saying this because you're a guest on our show, but that SummerSlam match with the Steiners is one of my kind of hidden favorite matches ever. I love that match. The crowd was so into it being in Michigan, and I thought you guys put on a great show. Right up there, too, was the match with the Rock and Roll Express, the Survivor Series in Boston. How unique was that match to put on that card? It felt so different than anything we had seen at the time. And especially for fans like myself that hadn't really seen a lot of other work, especially of yours, it was really a cool little snapshot. Did you enjoy that match in that setting?
Well, I enjoyed the match. It just seemed like everybody in Boston hated it.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, that Boston crowd was a hard crowd anyway, but they just booed inside the building, man. It was like crap. Mm. It was almost like take your Southern match and go to hell. And that was something, again, you know, Jim was great at laying stuff out and had a great plan and I, you know, he really was the mastermind, and we had all this stuff laid out, and it was great, and we knew it, and we'd worked together before, but this was a pay-per-view, so you have to know what's coming next, because the truck wants to know what you're going to do. So we knew, and we went out there, and they hated it. They hated the rock and roll. They hated us, and that's what I remember most of it. It was like, man, here we are in Boston, and giving them this hell of a match, and they just shit all over us. So, and that's what I found a lot with the Northern crowd. We just, they didn't care for us. Or maybe they just didn't care for me. I don't know, man. But, and also, you know, when you're in WWF or WWE, you have to know, you know, it is a business, and you have to advocate for yourself, and you have to be aggressive. And that was the farthest thing I had on my mind back then. So, you know, the whole gimmick was, while I was happy to be there, I wasn't happy being there, I guess, is the best way to say it.
Do you think part of it, too, is the way they positioned that match and sold it? Like, maybe they didn't do you favors by basically saying, hey, these teams are from the South. This is a Southern-style Smoky Mountain tag team title match. Like, maybe that was part of it, too. So the fans were kind of like, maybe they wouldn't have recognized as much that that's where you guys are from and that's what it was if they didn't push it that way. It kind of odd, because their MO for years before that was to bury any past, you know, Harley Race was not even talked about as being one of the all-time greats when he came in.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, 1993, here they are parading you guys out as being straight-up Southern tag teams.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, but because that, you know, the Civil War is still alive down here. I don't know about up there, but man, oh man, you know, and it's just, it's one of those things that, you know, you go out and you work hard, then you realize, look, they're not going to give you a shot either way. And I didn't want to think that way, but as time went on, I kind of went, yeah, that's what it is. And nowadays, when I watch WWE, I think it's a lot different, because they do appreciate good hard work, and they do appreciate the guys that go out there and they can tell when they're impassioned and believe in what they're doing. So back then, no, I think they were just going to show us that, yeah, you Southern boys go on that back down to Knoxville and take your match and have it every night if you want, but not up here.
On your return to Smoky Mountain, winning the tag titles again when you went back with Jimmy in 95, thoughts on that return? Probably happy after what you've been telling us the last few minutes, but what were your thoughts on heading back down there?
Well, here's what happened. We actually got called into a dressing room in Louisville, Kentucky, and we got fired. You know, but they told us, you know, Jimmy wants you guys back in Smoky Mountain. He really needs you. And I'm looking at JJ and I'm looking at Vince, because Vince fired everybody, I think, personally at that time. So, and I knew, and I was already kind of, I wasn't happy. Again, I had a lot of other things in my life going on, but I knew what they were doing. It's like, you know, Jimmy really needs you. Yeah, right. Jimmy could do without us, but anyway, it was okay going back. I was still living in Knoxville anyway. I'm flying out of Knoxville. But we knew the territory was on its last legs. So, you know, as it went, when we went back, it was we were trying to do the thing with USWA and working with Memphis back and forth and things like that. But at the same time, it wasn't going to be a money-making deal, and Jimmy was losing everything. So we knew it was just going to be a short time. And after that, you know, I think I made a couple of appearances at a Royal Rumble or Survivor Series again. And then they offered me the gig with Chris. So it was a short-lived stay the second time of Smoky Mountain, and we knew it was going to be short-lived.
What were the ultimate reasons for the failing of that? I mean, was it more a victim of the culture of wrestling changing? Was it anything Jimmy could have done to save it?
No. Jimmy was a one-man show, and I think it was just the fact that the world was changing, people were changing, attitudes were changing, the business had changed. You know, you can't survive if nobody's coming out to watch your product. And, you know, while we had some good houses, we didn't have them good enough to where, you know, we could survive. So Jimmy was doing everything. He was just pretty much a one-man show. And I just think at that time, the business had really pretty much changed, and it was WWE or WCW, and that was it. As far as making a living in the business.
Mm-hmm. All right, then we get to early 1996, and you go from a heavenly body to a body Donna. Hair change and everything.
Yeah.
What are your memories of both Chris and Sonny when you guys got together, and then the run you had at that point?
Well, I tell you what, man, I love Chris. I've known Chris since he was in Smoky Mountain, and he was a passionate guy about wrestling. He loved the business, would do anything for the business, and he was a great guy. He's a hell of a worker too, but young Sonny knew she was a hot little toy, and she didn't mind flaunting it to anybody and everybody. So it really made an uncomfortable time to be around her, because she was just such a bitch. And she didn't mind being a bitch.
She first arrived, huh, in 95 into 96? I thought, at least from we know as fans, we didn't think that kind of happened till like mid to late 97. We didn't think when she first came in, she had that attitude.
No, she was always a bitch. I mean, she knew it from Smoky Mountain. She was just that, you know, she knew she was hot, and everybody let her know she was hot. And that was the biggest mistake anybody could do. But I mean, you couldn't help it. She was just young and didn't care. She wasn't afraid. She flaunted it. So I really got a taste of it when I became partners and tried to travel with Chris and Tammy. I did it one time. I rode in the car with them one time, and she was just so nasty and berated Chris so much. And I got to the building, went right to Undertaker, asked if I can ride her back to the town with him. I don't remember what town it was. Just went and asked if I could ride with them, because it was bad. It was really bad. So,
did they have a volatile relationship between the two of them? They went out it seemed like they were together forever.
Yeah.
But were they always like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It was pretty nasty backstage. It was pretty nasty everywhere. It's just, and that's where a lot of the conflict came from, is Tammy didn't understand that she was really making things. Well, I think she did understand, quite honestly. I just don't think she cared. You know, it was one of those things that she just had to have her way and was going to let you know it was going to be her way or no way. And that was it. So, again, you know, we traveled different by ourselves, and they went where they went, and I went where I went. We just met up at the arena. So
The year that you guys were together in 96, the tag division seemed pretty lost at the time. I mean, even as a kind of a fan out of the know at the time, it felt a little bit shaky.
It sucked.
Right, it sucked. It was a shitty tag division.
It was a shit show.
I mean, the straight up lack of depth, or this using everyone incorrectly? Because if you look at the talent in place, I mean, you know, people bag on the Godwins, but maybe just misused in that run. And you and Candido, Tom Pritchard and Chris Candido as a team sounds a lot better than Dyed Blonde Body Donnas. And even the Smoking Guns could compete. And I mean, it seemed like talent was there. It seemed so directionless.
Well, nobody cared about tag teams. Nobody really cared. I mean, if you're putting a tag team, you knew it was kind of because they didn't know what to do with you and didn't know what to do with the other guy. So you're in a tag team because you're under contract. And by that time, I think you had Marty and Al Snow, the Godwins, who I love to death. But once again, you know, they're hillbillies. How are you gonna get serious about the hillbillies, right?
Vince loves his hillbillies.
Vince did love his hillbillies.
Henry Godwin, you know, Henry O, and P.I.G. So, you know, we knew. I knew. It just sucked, and I was just one of those deals where, as soon as they cut my hair and dyed blonde, I mean, I was looking for direction, but at the same time, again, it's one of those times in my life where there were outside forces interfering, and not where I wanted to say, look, man, this sucks, let's do something else, because I was preoccupied. And when they took Sonny away from us and put Cloudy with us.
Oh, that's where I was going next. Cloudy.
I knew it would be, because there's only one way to go. And that was the worst. I mean, Chris even told Vince that was the stupidest idea he's ever heard.
Awful.
And I thought, yeah, it is, but shit, we need a job. So went ahead and did it, and we sucked on that. Everything. I mean, we knew it sucked, and I hate that was when it got to the point. The dark days were really getting darker, you know, because I hated going to work. I hated dealing with Sonny. I hated watching her berate Chris. I hated knowing what she was doing while Chris was in the ring sometimes at the singles matches, or even when we were in tag matches. Come back, and I knew exactly what happened because the guys were taught. So, I mean, it couldn't get any worse, I think, but I'm sure it could have. You know, I mean, at least I was still working. But looking back on it, I wish I would have done a lot of things differently, but I can't change the past, so got to move forward.
Did you have a favorite match? As frustrated as you were, do you have a favorite match that you enjoyed, that you loved working in during this stretch?
No.
Your whole run. Even go back to 90. We'll say the whole run from 93 all the way to now, all the way to this point, 96.
You know, maybe the Steiners and a couple Smoking Guns matches, possibly, and the Rock and Roll. But other than that, you know, it's pretty much nobody cared. Pat Patterson didn't like us very much at all. I don't know if he hated us. But I could tell there was this attitude, man. And I pretty much, instead of saying something and doing something about it, you know, I sat back and just didn't want to make waves. And you can't do that if you want to change things. You know, I should have said something, but... Once again, that's my fault. I have nobody to blame but myself. And that's why we tell young guys today, listen, you've got to speak up. You've got to have ideas. You've got to learn how to eat shit, learn to love the taste of shit. But I got to the point where I was just sick of eating shit every day, and eventually I'll get sick of it or change it. And, you know, I didn't change it. I just got sick of it and let it, and didn't do anything about it. Until I started training people. And until I got in the office and saw the other side of the fence and saw how it really works.
Let me ask you that as an extension. You talked about how Pat was maybe not a big fan, or maybe he was grumpy. As we're in this stretch, 95 into 96, WCW is ramping themselves up. They started Nitro, giving away the results. And then obviously by May, the NWO started. was there an effect backstage, do you think? Because do you think Vince was grumpy and Pat was grumpy and everybody was just rankled that that WCW was making this play? And you think maybe that's what caused kind of the malaise or in terms of the day-to-day things in WWF at that time in 96? Because they saw WCW was leaning on them?
Yeah, not as far as we were concerned. I think they just hated us. I think they just didn't see anything there, and they just hated us. But I'm sure it had something to do with the way they were on other things. But, I mean, you know, you had other guys working. You had Shawn. You had Diesel. You had Razor. You had Kid. You had the Click. You had those guys. And I had nothing against those guys either. They did what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to go in there and get their spots and fight and keep their spots, and they did. And you had Davey Boy, you had Owen, you had Brett, you had a lot of guys who'd been there for a while and knew how to go in and get what they wanted. And here we come from Smoky Mountain, you know, and I was with Jimmy Del Rey, and we weren't really great partners backstage. And Jimmy sometimes did things that didn't endear himself to people backstage too, you know, I mean, but we all did. And, I just think that, I just think there were a lot of issues and a lot of elements that didn't play well for me, or I didn't play well with others, I guess, back then. I don't know, man. I just think that they didn't see us as anything but what we were going to be used for. And at that time, I was happy with it. I was just happy to be there. Now, looking back on it, I should have not been just happy to be there. I should have been advocating for myself, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. So nobody blamed but myself.
So after that, you stepped out of the ring for a bit, worked behind the scenes for the company. Was it immediate after the Bad Dynamics? I know, Candido hurt his neck, and then it seemed like you hung around, a little bit more on TV, and then just kind of vanished. Did you go right backstage behind the scenes?
Yeah, it was. After I worked a couple matches after Chris broke his neck, then Vince asked me if I wanted to start training people. And I said, sure. And he said, well, it means you might have to spend a lot more time at Stanford. And I said, great. I'd love to. So I moved to Stanford and started working out in the studio with The Rock and Occam Albrecht and Mark Henry. And then I was going to all the TVs, and Michael Hayes invited me to go to a writer's meeting one time. And I went to that, and I really opened my eyes to how all you have to do is suggest something, and it may be good, it may be bad, but just keep suggesting something. And I didn't have a lot of suggestions back then, but I suggested a few things. And then I listened to the way talent was thought of and talent was talked about. And I thought, man, you know, it really makes a lot more sense if you just speak up. Mm-hmm. If you have a good idea, if you have an idea you believe in and you pull it off, then it's up to you. So, I mean, I saw that side of it. Before, I didn't want to be there, didn't want to butt heads because, again, my brother being in the office could be – I don't want to make excuses. I really don't. I just didn't – I went backstage shortly after Chris broke his neck, and I found a whole different attitude, different world. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
What was it like back there when they were making the decision, or, you know, coming to the decision that they needed to go in a different direction? End of 97, the Attitude stuff, a little more realistic. You had Cornette doing the shoot promos on TV. Jarrett came back ripping on WCW, and then Vince's infamous speech. Like, what were the weeks leading up to that backstage? Were you involved in those discussions?
I was in the room, but I mean, it was just, again, it was the attitude of let's hit them hard. You know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go at them with all barrels, full barrels. Let's just shoot on. And I think when you get to that point and you do the vignettes with Hogan and Macho Man and things like that, well, that's the kind of stuff that makes people start paying attention. And also at the time you had talent like Mick Foley and The Rock and The Undertaker really coming on strong. So I think everybody's attitude was, you might beat us now, but you're not going to beat us in the end. And that's kind of what I remember is, you know, guys, when Jericho came, and then you had Eddie and Saturn Malenko and Eddie, Saturn, Malenko, and who else? Was it three guys?
Eddie, Saturn, Malenko. Benoit.
Benoit, thank you. Thank you. Wow, how could I forget that?
Well, I didn't know if you were doing the...
I don't know if you're doing that on purpose or not.
He's scratched from history.
No,
okay.
No, I wasn't. Trust me. No, but I mean, when they came over, and, you know, again, I think that's the kind of stuff that got everybody's attention, sitting in the crowd. And mm-hmm. I remember when Eddie came out and did his frog splash and dislocated his elbow that night.
Oh, yeah.
It was
like,
that was nasty.
Yeah, it was nasty. But again, it was those kind of things that you would have looked at before going, there's no way they're going to do this, and no way Vince would let this happen. Well, yeah, he would, because he's that guy. You know, Vince doesn't back away from a fight. In fact, he's the guy who double dog dare you. And sometimes he'll throw the first punch and the last. So, and that was the attitude backstage. He just didn't care. I mean, he cared about his business, but he wasn't caring about offending anybody or pissing anybody off. In fact, he was looking to piss people off, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the attitude backstage, I thought.
Two angles that you were directly involved in during that stretch, I wanted your comments on. The scab referees and the tail end of Jeff's run in 99 when he was hating on women and that started the feud with China and ultimately led to his departure. Did you enjoy your involvement with those storylines?
Yeah, you know, I guess, but at the same time, man, it's gonna sound kind of, I don't know how it's gonna sound, so I'll just say it. I really liked being backstage. I mean, I didn't really care for going out and being one of the guys pulling the guys apart or anything like that. But the scab referee deal, I don't even remember how that came up. I just remember Vince saying, "Hey, you want to be a referee?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And it was like that. And then I remember China gave me a pedigree, and I didn't sell it good enough for him, and he got pissed off at that. you know what I mean? Little things like that. So I would have just said, I'd rather just stay backstage. But then the deal with Jeff, that was a Russo deal. I think with Jeff and I against China and Cat. I'm not sure who the tag match was. Yeah, you don't need that great angle that we did. Anyway, yeah,
very memorable.
Now,
very
yeah, memorable. Right. No, I enjoyed it because it was being a part of it. But at the same time, at that stage of my life, I was pretty much content being backstage and being in the background, and because it just you know,
it was Deborah. It looks like
Deborah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. I thought it was. It was cool, but at the same time, I didn't really care about being in front of the camera anymore.
Any memories? So past that, you started co-hosting Bite This. Memories or any cool stories from that show early in the internet's run with that kind of thing? I mean, look at us now. Everyone's got a podcast and a show. But that was really the earliest wrestling version up there with, I think, Dave Meltzer had his around that time, too. Any stories from that?
Well, you know, I was happy to be involved in that one with Kevin because I had an office or was working over at the studio with the guys and was around the office all day now, and it was kind of cool to just be in that environment. And I remember I think it was Jim Monty's and can't remember the other producer now, but who did it. And we always had either pizza or food or something and come up and just go over the show. I mean, I can't remember anything specifically, and I wish I could. But, you know, because Kevin and I we made a lot of trips. We had a lot of fun. That's probably why I can't remember it right now. But, I mean, Bite This was cool because you're right. It was one of the first shows. And then I remember they were going to take it off and then say, oh, we're just going to take it off for a little bit, and it's going to come right back. Well, you've seen it back, haven't you? So that was like 15 years ago. 20 years ago, I didn't come back. I don't know. I just remember having a cool time with the guests, whoever we called, and just going back and forth talking about wrestling.
What led to your departure from the company in 2004?
Well, that was my doing by. Let's just say I probably sent an email to somebody I shouldn't have sent an email to. And we had a difference of opinion of how to run things. And by that time, I was already getting to the point where I was butting heads with John Laurinaitis. And I should have just shut up. But I couldn't shut up because I didn't believe in what he was saying would work for developmental. I had my way of doing it, and John thought he had the better way. And it all came down to John was going to win because John was the head of developmental, and that's pretty much how he said, let's agree to disagree. This is your last day here. So that was what happened.
You came back. You trained 2007 to 2012. Who were your prized pupils? Anybody not make it that you were sure would?
Well, I don't know. I thought Kurt Hopkins would have made it for sure because he's a talented guy, but he's not a politician. You know, I thought Heath Slater would have made it just because he's a lot more charismatic than they've been able to show on TV, even though he's he's involved now. But I mean, Tyson Kidd, another guy who I think is extremely talented. But for some reason, they aren't really doing much with him. Harry Smith, another guy who came in. I mean, guys who came through, they're not who started with us necessarily, but there have been a lot of guys who came through and did make it. So, and by the way, Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins came from FCW. They didn't come from NXT. So, just set the record straight. But no, man, I mean, I can't think right off the top of my head, you know, from FCW, because most of the guys who did go, they got a break, they got on TV, and then it was left to their own devices. I think Damian Sandow would have been a lot bigger. I'm glad he's getting a shot now as Mrs.
Stunt double.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. But I could see him in another role because I think he's extremely talented, and I think he's a great athlete. But there are a lot of guys that came through that I said, yeah, this guy's never going to make it. And, of course, they made it. And I can't think of any specific names right now. But Justin Gabriel's another guy real quick who I thought would have been a lot bigger than he is now.
Well, what's your feeling just on the direction of the business and WWE at this point? I mean, did the network model work in your eyes as something that they need to stay committed to? Obviously, I mean, obviously they sunk a lot into it. I mean, is that the future of things? What is your thought? Just obviously, you're a fan. You watch Raw. It seems like we're talking about it before we went on air. I mean, do you watch every week? Do you enjoy some? Hate other? I mean, does it piss you off? Like, just what's your feeling on their overall product?
Well, I do believe that time marches on, and you can't stay complacent. You can't stay in the olden days. You can't go back. You have to go forward. From what I understand, the internet is the future. Now, whether that's the case or not, I really don't know. I mean, I like the network. I don't have a chance to watch it too much, but I will watch the pay-per-views, and I'll watch when I get a chance. But, you know, it doesn't piss me off. It makes me wonder sometimes if we're ever going to find another Austin, or if that time when the Attitude Era really took off, if that boom will ever happen again. But it's going to take something special or someone special to come along. I don't see anybody out there right now. I don't see anybody out there on the horizon. But the network, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know that many more casual fans than they've already got, but they haven't gone to every country they go to, I guess, who want to pay $9.99 to watch more wrestling when you have at least 5 hours and more of free wrestling every week. Mm-hmm. You know, me, because I would like to watch something from the past, or I'll watch the pay-per-views, and it's a great deal for me, but for the casual fan who just watch on Monday or don't mind paying for one pay-per-view but aren't going to pay for them all, you know, maybe that's, you know, not so much. Are they going to buy the internet or the network? So I don't know, man. It's I do know this. I do know that WWE is always on the lookout for the next star. But with 3 hours on a Monday night, you have to invest in 3 hours you know, after working all day or doing whatever you're going to do, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. That is a lot. And then to invest in more time on the weekends to watch the internet, on the network, I don't know. I mean, it remains to be seen because the network isn't even a year old, right?
Correct. Started in February.
Oh, yep. Okay, that's fine. But, I mean, you've got to give it a couple of years at least. Mm-hmm. And one thing they're good at doing is waiting. And they've always said it's a marathon, not a sprint. So I think, you know, for me, the jury's still out on the network. I think there's some great stuff on it. But is there enough great stuff to get whatever they need? I think they need over 1 million just to break even. Is that right? 1 million subscribers?
I think it's changed. I know it was higher than that for a bit, and then when they made all those budget cuts, it went back down. So it's kind of been a floating number. I think the next conference call is coming up soon, so that should be interesting.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, Vince doesn't mind sticking it out, and that's been proven. So he doesn't mind waiting. At the same time, you know, how long is too long, and when's he going to draw the line? That's the question, because I think he's going to give it at least 2 or 3 years, and if it doesn't do anything, he might. But that's a big might.
And I think he has to, because I mean, I don't know how you get that pay per view cap back in the bag. I mean, how do you now retrain people to pay $50 for it again? So,
that's what I'm saying. Is some people will just buy the pay per view and pay that $50. Some people will.
Right, but even the ones that haven't. Now, I mean, I'm on the network, and I mean, I wasn't a big pay-per-view purchaser before. I was a kind of a bar goer to watch him. But, I mean, I don't know how you can tell someone that it's worth $10, and then all of a sudden all those people paying $10, now you're saying, oh, we don't offer that anymore, so if you want to see it, you're going to pay $55 again.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you do have that. You do have that issue. Yeah, it is kind of hard to downplay it and then all of a sudden say it's worth more now. But, you know, I think 12 pay-per-views a year is a lot anyway. I mean, my God, man. So I know people who just bought WrestleMania and the Royal Rumble before. And again, like you said, go to a bar and watch it. It's a lot cheaper.
And that's a great plug, Dr. Tom, because we have a great podcast up right now from Goodwill Wrestling on PlaySimulation.com, how to fix the WWE pay-per-view schedule. So everyone out there should listen to that after this.
That is.
Brock Lesnar, just one last final question on the current product. What do you think of him being champion? Are you on board with that? Kevin and I talked about it last Wednesday, and I know Scott's talked about it on his show, the main event. I mean, I feel this guy should be champion through, like, SummerSlam next year, if not longer, and really try and find someone to build and build and build to beat him. I mean, I'm fine with them not having the champion on all the time. I'm fine with him only showing up here and there. I think it makes the belt seem more credible. I think he's the best, or at least, you know, top five guy they have. I think he's one of the few spectacles they have, and I think they should ride this as long as they can. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. The guy's a former MMA champion. He's a legit fighter. He's a legit badass. Why wouldn't you keep the title on him? Why wouldn't you not have him on every week? I think familiarity breeds contempt. And to a point, you know, it's great to see Brock on Raw or SmackDown, but at the same time, let the champion be off. Pay to see the champion. That makes perfect sense. And he is the guy. He is a legit badass. And after what he did with John Cena the last two pay-per-views, I don't know of anybody else. Everybody talks about Roman Reigns. Let me just say for the record, I like Roman Reigns. I think he's going to be very good and even great later down the road. Right now, I don't see him as being ready for Brock. Mm-hmm. I think I think he has a ways to go. And I said that in some interview, and I got jumped all over talking about it. I didn't know what I was talking about. And that's great. That's cool. I may not. But at the same time, after what he did to Cena, 16 suplexes in the last match he had, you know, he showed some vulnerability. You got to have somebody on Cena's level or above it, and there's nobody out there, in my opinion, except The Rock. And does Rock want to come back and do WrestleMania 31? I don't know, but I think Lesnar is the guy, and he's the only real choice right now. And I think it's a smart move to keep him off TV, keep him away until you know, it's time, and make people pay to see him.
I mean, I feel he should hold to WrestleMania 32, and then you do Reigns. By then, he should be ready. I would let him hold it for that long.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, don't do it to the guy before he's ready. I mean, you're just shoving him. I like the guy. I like Roman Reigns. I've known him since he started, and he was in developmental. He's got potential, but don't put him along that road too much. He hasn't had those big matches yet. He's had it with Seth. He's had it with – he beat Seth. My God, he beat Seth before the pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason he didn't have the match is because he got a hernia and had to go in for surgery. So, I mean, what big matches does he have under his belt to give him credibility to work with Brock? I don't see it yet. But, you know, I do see somebody like Rock, or and I don't know any other badass that can come in and beat Brock or even have the people believe that he can be beat.
Mm-hmm. Wow, speaking of The Rock, I think you are some kind of magic going on here, Dr. Tom. As you discussed The Rock returning, he just showed up on Raw. Sorry to spoil it for you, Scott, but he literally walked out. He literally just walked out, as you said, that The Rock may be the guy to come back. I mean, I'm not even kidding with the timing on this.
Wait, I'm watching Rusev on Raw.
Yeah, you might be like a minute behind. I'm sorry to spoil it for you as well, but it blew my mind that you talked about it right as he was.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, now he is coming out, of course.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, well, but there you go. That's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a guy that everybody knows. He's not just a wrestler. He's not just a badass. He's an action figure. He's an action hero. He's that guy. So, yeah, there's your Brock Lesnar opponent, but looks like he's coming out to defend the U.S. of A. I don't know.
Pretty crazy timing. All right, so story time. We got a couple of requests here from our good friend Kevin Kelly on Twitter. And then I think we may have a few minutes for a little of your favorite game here at PTB and Dr. Tom. It's a little sleaze thread, true or false. What do you think?
Sure, go right ahead.
All right, let's do the two Kevin questions. He wants you to talk first about the time that Toto froze. Hashtag Dr. Tom's fault.
Oh, Jesus.
Now, is this the band, the dog?
Toto? Well, no. It's my daughter.
Oh.
My daughter, when she was a very little girl, she had this dog, and it was, she named it Toto.
Oh, good. Okay. I thought I offended your daughter at first. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, no, that's quite all right.
Okay. It's,
yeah. Anyway, it was in San Antonio, Texas, very cold night, and the grandmother, my first wife, not my second wife, not my wife presently, but the first one, grandmother wouldn't allow the dog in on a very cold night. And the next day she came to me and said, "Dom, Toto froze, bury him before Stephanie gets up." I thought, what a nasty bitch. I mean, that was what it was. That's a pretty nasty story, but that's just some of the things I was dealing with back then.
Everybody no. down to days. He also said, ask him about the grapple and the gravel.
Oh, okay. Well, oh, man. You know, the grapple and the gravel goes back a long way, guys. That was something that, you know, we talked about off the air with one of your guests. One of the guests you asked me to try and help you book. I think he's over it by now, but. But Tracy Smothers and I had a difference of opinion one night, and I won't go into all the details. It's a little too long, and I'm a little too long-winded for it. And I was riding with Brian Lee from the town, and Tracy was riding with the Rock and Roll Express, and we happened to pass them as they were on the side of the road taking a urine sample, I guess. Well, I told Brian to pull over, and he said, no, let's just move on. And then they passed us on the road as you know, we're going farther. And finally, Brian blinked the lights. We pulled them over, and Tracy and I got out, and it was words said and beer bottles thrown. And then we commenced a fighting in the gravel on the side of the road. And as this was happening, some girl stopped, and Ricky Morton said some choice words to her, which she proceeded to call the police because not 30 seconds later, a cop came behind us and on the side of the road with the lights flashing. And we went over and told him we were working on spots on the side of the road. And he says, "You don't do that in my state. You better get in your car and go now." And Tracy looked at me and says, "This isn't over yet." and I thought, no, sure isn't. But anyway, that was just it. There were things that led up to it, and me being me at that time, kind of egged it on, I guess. It was my fault that happened, but my fault a lot of things happen in life. So that was the grappling and the gravel. A lot more to it than that, but that's the short one.
Very good. All right, so here are a couple of sleaze thread entries. If you remember, you played this when you were on Kevin's show. So you just tell me and Scott, and we're going to have Scott guess as well, percentage of how true they are out of 100% here. So here's okay. The first one. We're going to come strong out of the gate this time. Shawn Michaels got Marty Jannetty a hooker for his birthday, had her show up at the TV studio on the day of interview tapings, and give him a blowjob while the cameras were left running. Vern Gagne's daughter showed up at the studio that day while the production crew was watching a replay of the action.
Ooh.
I would have believed it. I would have believed it until the Vern Gagne daughter thing. Okay. That part I don't believe. The earlier part, most definitely.
Yeah, I've got to believe the earlier part. I'm not so sure about Gagne's daughter walking in either, but I would certainly believe the first part.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly not out of the realm of possibilities, man. I could tell you some stories of what those guys did, like on airplanes and stuff like that. But we won't.
Oh, we can get one story, no?
No, because I think the statute of limitations is still out.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If that's the case, then we definitely want to protect the innocent.
Yeah, we won't.
All right. Larry Zbyszko's first wife had nude photos taken of herself and would leave them on the cars of the boys with her phone number and address.
Well, my first wife did, but... I don't know about that, man, but then again, as I said, my first wife was pretty nasty. So I don't know, it's possible. But no, I don't think that's true. That sounds like something Larry might have made up.
All right. Ahmed Johnson supposedly bragged about how when he was pimping underage girls, he had them so pimped that he used their tongues for toilet paper.
Ahmed's full of shit. Yeah.
No, 0%. Even though he says he's full of shit and had them wipe it, no.
No. I think that's crazy. No, I don't
believe Ahmed just being Ahmed. Moadib being Moadib.
Right.
All right, here's a fun one. Jake Roberts, working an NWA Southwest show against somebody. While he had this guy in a chin lock, Jake proceeded to stick his index finger in the poor guy's ass, and then hit the DDT. The guy was upset that he was a victim of these antics, kicked out of the pin, and said, "That's what you get." Jake, now having his heat killed off, finished the match by hitting the guy with his leather boots.
Ooh. Well, if you tell me who it was, I might know if it was true or not.
Knowing Jake?
Oh, this is it's a guy I never heard of. This is Kevin Northcutt. I wasn't going to.
Kevin Northcutt?
Yeah.
I believe it.
Anything with Jake. Yeah. I can believe anything with Jake. Yeah.
You have any good Jake stories for us?
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I can't tell those either.
Those I wouldn't think so.
We got to find one you can tell us. All right. Let's see. It was well circulated back in the day that when Dutch Mantel was doing the Uncle Zebekiah gimmick at a motel one night, he and Eli Blue got really fucked up on no-dos and wood alcohol, shaved off a bunch of Dutch's back hair, glued it to his crotch, and had Eli eat him out.
Oh, no, man. No.
What the hell?
That ain't going to happen.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, I knew both those guys, and that's not even up there. I'm not drunk or anything. Yeah, that's not even close. Now the other one, Eli and Jacob. Now, Jacob, maybe, but not Eli. No. I know the twins.
All right, I'm trying to find another good one here that may actually be legitimate. Let's see.
Hmm. That Ahmed Johnson one is ridiculous.
Yeah, Ahmed was kind of crazy. You know.
Yeah, I don't believe much he said.
Yeah, can't believe almost anything.
But... Wait, wasn't Larry Zbyszko's wife Vern's daughter?
Yeah,
oh, it all exactly. comes together now. So maybe she was into that video.
Maybe she did walk in on. So, wow, that's a... No, I don't think.
All right, so here's a famous one, Dr. Tom. I know we did this one, Kevin, before. I'm curious your talk. The Rock and Roll Express walk in on Jimmy Valiant laying on the floor, jerking off under a glass table that had a hooker taking a shit on it. Ricky threw up, and Robert stayed.
No, I have heard that one, sure. Johnny Valentine was famous for that, too, you know.
shitting on the table or laying under it?
Yes.
Or laying under it.
Having the hooker or having someone shit on the table as you watched.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't get it either, man, but I mean, I'm just saying.
No. Junior Donnelly seemed like an odd guy anyway, so. Yes.
And you know, that's why I wouldn't put it past him. I mean, I love Boogie Woogie Man too, but you know, we all have our things, I guess.
He boogies and he woogies.
Yes, he does.
When the time is right.
Yeah.
All right, I'll try and find one more here. Do you have one? You could have one really good road story you could share with us before we go. Just one really, one that's gonna make Scott laugh out loud in his
I don't know
Scott
if,
laugh.
You know, yeah, I don't know if I can. I can actually. I gotta think of one that I could really get away with and tell.
You could even use fake names if you want. Just give us the story. You can use Kevin Northcutt as your
Satan
as your generic name.
Ooh, okay.
You could say they're in the Dungeon of Doom or something. It's all right.
No, okay. Well, I can do that, I guess. But if I don't use the real names, the name...
All right, use the real names. I'm not going to stand in your way.
Yeah, because, I mean, Frank Morrell wouldn't mind. You know who Frank Morrell is?
Name sounds familiar.
Referee in Memphis?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, well... Well, God, Frank looked like her grandfather when he was 30, but...
wow, premature graying, huh?
No hair.
Oh.
Yeah. Frank liked to do some crazy things with... I can't even say that because that's just such... with young girls and maybe three or four guys. And by the time Frank got there... she was appalled and repulsed, but there was nothing she could do about it. And that's almost against the law. See, that's why I can't.
Yikes.
I gotta think real hard about that. But God, I can't.
Well, you'll definitely be back with us at some point.
Yeah. So. I was going to say, give me a chance, man, because there's stuff I can tell you, but I don't know if they're for consumption because the last time I said something, I really didn't think this interview was going too far. And then all of a sudden, people picked up on it and said, well, you said Roman Reigns sucked. And I really didn't say sucked. I just said he wasn't ready for Brock. Mm. Anyway, but if I tell a story and then people say, can you believe what those guys did? And so, I mean, the statute of limitations. And Kevin Kelly can probably tell you some things.
Oh, he has.
Yeah, and off the air, I'm sure.
Maybe.
Oh, no, that bastard. Anyway.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Tom. So we'll let you get off the hot seat a little bit there.
I appreciate
that. We really appreciate you taking this time. We know you got a big trip to Germany this week, and you took some time with us to join to take a break from packing, watching Raw. I made you miss The Rock. I'm sorry about that, but
that's okay, man. It's all good. I'll watch it back.
So some great stories, some great trips through time here. I know our old school fans are gonna love it, and we got to have you back on because I feel like there's definitely more. Ground to mine, even just outside of your career, just the things you've seen and your thoughts as a fan, growing up as a fan, like more like top five list kind of stuff. So we gotta set something up and have you back here. How's that sound?
I appreciate it, man. Anytime. Yeah, it's been kind of a long day. It's been kind of a long week. I'm getting ready to have a long 10 days, but yeah, I do appreciate it, man. I'll talk about some stories and I'll think of some stuff I can talk about without getting anybody else in trouble or a rumor started that maybe. Incriminating, yeah, because there involves a hairbrush and a razor and some other stuff too that I really don't, you know, I can misuse it, but that might be, you know, circumstances incriminating of others and me at the same time. So anyway. But I appreciate it, guys. Yeah, I'd love to be back anytime.
Of course. So that is the one and only, the great Dr. Tom Pritchard here on the Place to Be podcast. Great interview there, Scott. Dr. Tom.
He was awesome.
Yeah, great guy. A lot of stories, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about with him in the future because he's going to be maybe a semi-regular. We just, off air, we're talking about a cool idea maybe to do with him in the future that we can announce where he'll be kind of have his own regular thing here at PlaceToBeNation.com. So.
Yeah, maybe very cool.
We will talk about that in the coming week. So we are back Wednesday night with Bad Blood 2003 as we move through the year. Next Tuesday, we're off Monday. We'll be back Tuesday night with our SmackDown Live Watch. We'll have Aaron George, Jason Greenhouse, Dr. G back in the house to watch the next episode 2 of SmackDown. And then next Wednesday, we have the Kevin Kelly Show and Main Event, episodes 20, Scott. Can you believe it?
Can't believe it. We have reached 20. That's awesome. It's amazing.
Very cool. So, yeah. All right, let's wrap up. PlaceToBeNation.com, Visit often, every day, multiple times. Vote in the character tournament. Read the articles. Listen to the podcast. Subscribe to the feeds. And keep supporting us like you always do. We really appreciate it. So, for Scott, I am Justin. We'll be back Wednesday night. Bad blood.
See, even he doesn't like Moadib.
I'm just, reading that story. Dan McGinn was here. I'm glad I don't have a glass coffee table in this basement, because I don't know what could have happened on Saturday night. Especially if Carino would have been here, pissing on Lita, McGinn on the... forget it. Well, those wings, though, so, yeah. Some hot dames. Tonight's audience received mid-screen video games and 15 seconds of fame. Pitiful lames. It's just a shame. Zoning. Competing for the same prime time slot as Conan. No dummy Ichigawa. Announcement. Free lunch journey stunt who lets me flower in the shower for an hour. The kid's supposed to be asleep. Balls to join the sound like Roadrunner. Beep, beep. Later this week, Big Ben Klingon. After him, there's no one else we could afford to bring on. Keep it ghetto and let them know BYOB from the get-go. I like to propose a toast to the grocer's host. Space holes, coast to coast. That destructor is a played-out gag in a cape and a pantsuit. Looking like a straight-out dag. Don't mean to sound crunchy. Hit a honey from the back and crumpled up a scrunchie. A light snack, hungry munchie. Felt a funny hunch, then she told him, donkey punch me. Tomorrow is Father Guido Sarducci, Father MC, and Charo Coochie Coochie with her new bestseller, Who You Call a Hoochie, a proud sponsor of the Snoochie Boochie Noochies. Look Leela eyeball to eyeballs and find out how they get inside them sugar pie walls. Our next guest, a real cutie specimen, and she's starting to get a little booty, Miss Judy Jetson. So Judy, boxers, briefs, or fig leaf. As you know, I wear my boxers, so my big... Cue the rapper, tell him bring what little he got. Up against the Billy, it's really not diddly squat. Until they head hurts, when it come to wreck. Cruises like them dudes in red shirts off Star Trek. He Kirk, he Spock, he McCoy. Been B-boy since your judge first squeezed toys. Born to be the host with the most. When it's on, space holes, coast to coast.
You think I'm just gonna hand over my show to you, Doom? Have you lost your f***ing mind? Listen, I'm not going to hand my show over to you. You know why? Because it's my show. Mine, not yours. Space Ghost. It ain't Doom Coast to Coast. Yeah, sure. Here are the keys to the show. Why don't you drive for a while? Yeah, America's craving some Doom. Here you go.